Thank you everyone for taking the time out to come and listen to me and obviously the other speakers. I'm probably not going to speak in too much detail relevant to records, but what I'm hoping to give you today is some context of insurance, how we respond to losses in the public sector, but also private sector. And I will touch on records. And what I'm hoping for everyone here today is to see the importance of everyone joining together, bringing knowledge and skill set to an event in order to recover that event. So obviously damage, the journey from destruction to recovery. The idea of insurance is to make people whole and put them back in the position they were before. Just as an introduction to what we're going to talk about, I'll give you a brief history lesson on insurance. I'll talk about what a loss adjuster does. I'll make reference to iCare and Treasury Managed Fund, which obviously is the self-insured fund that provides coverage for agencies and the government. I'll talk about what happens when there is a claim, material damage and consequential loss implications, how we quantify and settle claims. I'll look at elements of recovery action or investigations relevant to potentially making sure that the interests of an agency are protected where they may have some exposure in a public or a professional liability element. And I'll touch on the new buzz, which is cybercrime. I will make reference to documents and archives during the course of the overview, but not in any great deal of specificity. In terms of the history of insurance, property insurance as we know it today is traced back to the Great Fire of London in 1666, when there was about 13,000 houses that were destroyed in the fire. That devastation caused people to look at the importance and explore the avenues of insurance coverage being provided. So through the late 17th century and early 18th century, you saw insurance schemes develop in response to the various business needs, business ventures, commercial enterprises, marine insurance, and the establishment of what you all know today is Lloyd's of London. Fire insurance companies established their own fire brigades, and affixed to each building, if you had insurance with that insurance company, was a fire insurance mark. That's what a mark looks like, that's a genuine mark, and I'm happy for you to hand that around and have a look at it. So effectively, if you were insured with insurance company ABC, then you had that fire mark attached to your building and there was a fire. The fire truck had come trundling down the street and they'd see the mark and they'd put your fire out. But if the building next door didn't have their mark, too bad. So that building was left to burn. So that was sort of the history and how it started. Today you can actually still see fire marks on buildings, obviously in the UK, in America and in Australia. And today fire levies that you pay on your property insurance premium is actually what goes to fund the insurance, the fire brigades and them trundling down the street without selecting against you putting your fire out. Oh my God, the chips or whatever might happen. So what is insurance? Essentially, insurance is buying protection from financial loss and about transferring risk. So in exchange for a relatively small outlay, which is the premium that you pay, a policyholder or insured will receive in exchange a promise from the insurance company insurer that it will compensate it in the event of a covered loss. In return for that payment of that premium, you receive a contract of insurance which will detail the terms and conditions under which you can claim and when a claim is accepted, the basis of settlement of that policy. It's common for insurers to engage loss adjusters, loss assessors to assist them in assessing, quantifying, and ultimately settling the claims. There's various classes of insurance, property, commercial, domestic, legal liability, marine, travel, you name it, you can generally insure it. So what is a loss adjuster and what does a loss adjuster do? When somebody asks me that question, I say quite often, it's a person that wears many hats and knows when to take one hat off and put another one on at the appropriate time. First and foremost, a loss adjuster requires technical insurance knowledge and expertise. Broadly, what a loss adjuster will do is generally they're the first person on the scene when something happens, ascertain the circumstances, and in consideration of coverage, provide advice and recommendations. They'll then assess the loss and assist in the recovery process and the reinstatement. They'll negotiate a claim settlement in consideration of all relevant factors that is acceptable to all parties. They'll look at things like responsible parties that may have caused a loss to identify recovery action and prospects. A loss adjuster, as I said, tends to wear lots of different hats, so we've got a few skills. Some of those are an ability to think outside the square, be proactive, manage the expectations of multiple stakeholders, have good communication skills, be a team player, show empathy, have negotiation skills, and fundamentally have ethics and integrity. In the capacity of the claims I handle for Treasury Managed Fund, TMF, which is obviously the acronym, is effectively administered by the iCare Self-Insurance, which provides government agencies and related businesses with comprehensive protection against loss, damage and liabilities. TMF is the largest public sector insurer in Australia and indemnifies its participating agencies with a comprehensive program of financial protection whilst providing the confidence that's necessary for losses that are unforeseen that may have an impact on state budgets and New South Wales communities. TMF outsources the management of its claims to GIO, who in turn instruct service providers such as loss adjusters, lawyers and the like. I've referred to an insurance policy. In the case of TMF claims, it's called a statement of cover. And in focusing primarily on property losses today, the statement of cover provides coverage to material damage and then consequential losses. And consequential losses can be many things which occur in consequence of the event which the material damage has triggered. Generally speaking, there's two specific arms to consequential loss. That one of them is protecting or reimbursing the loss of revenue, which an agency may suffer as a consequence of an event. And secondly, there's the additional expenditure which an agency may incur in order to maintain normal operations and or to reduce a potential loss of gross revenue. The photo on the left is an aerial photo that was taken of the Anzac Day 2015 Huntingwood hailstorm. That is an enormous logistics warehouse, and it was one of many that suffered catastrophic failure through that hailstorm. I've got to say, when I got out there and responded to things like this, I thought I'd seen it all, and I actually thought, you were looking at an earthquake damaged building. And the other one is an image from one of the Dungog floods and the various floods that we've had in recent years throughout New South Wales. The basis of settlement under your statement of cover, as I said, is covering material damage. It covers the agency for the reinstatement or the cost of replacing what's been lost or damaged on, and you may have heard the term new for old. That is, it doesn't take into account age, wear and tear, deterioration or condition of the property at the time. You might rebuild a fire-damaged building, you might replace some IT equipment, you might dry, restore and copy archives that have been damaged. You might demolish and remove debris, and you'd also cover various consultant expenses associated with that. With the statement of cover, the key is for TMF that the costs are actually incurred, and then the agency is compensated. With consequential loss claims, as previously advised, you're looking at loss of revenue, loss of income, New South Wales Health, if there's an issue with a section of a hospital, they can't perform the procedures, they can't remit the revenue. So it's compensating the agency for the loss of revenue that might occur, or the additional expenditure that you might look to incur to mitigate or minimise those losses. That might be things like you'd employ additional staff to move patients from here to there so they could be looked after at a nearby hospital. Might mean that you're paying a doctor or a nurse additional wages to enable that to occur. The key being obviously responding to the community needs and the agency needs. A school fire, you might be hiring demountable buildings to replace the buildings that have burnt to the ground so that classes can still be taught. Those three photos, the one at the top is the Bundaberg floods of 2013. They got hit twice in a row, including the same year that Brisbane went underwater, and that matter is the subject of a current court case which is being held in the New South Wales Supreme Court. And the bottom one is the Christchurch earthquake of 2011, when there was significant loss of life. And the other is the Black Saturday bushfires, which I've got to say in my career is the hardest thing I've ever dealt with. When there's loss of life in a catastrophe, it does take on a whole different dimension. So the types of losses we have, it's the traditional ones we'd all know of. You've all got insurance policies, I'm sure, impact damage, fire, major storm, hail events, flooding, bushfires. The damage can be extensive and catastrophic, and operations can cease immediately. There's other losses, such as malicious damage or loss of valuable items, rare books, antiquities, fine art and that sort of thing. Art can be damaged through water, smoke, sometimes art gets stolen. The damage and the response to the event, we look at all heads of claim. So if you could imagine if something happened here today, we've got base building, we've got contents, we've got IT, then we've got the staff in the building and the operations and how you respond to that. There'll be the documents and the files and the records out in the back room. So it's everything. When you respond to an event, as I said, generally the loss adjuster is one of the first people on the scene. And it's about quickly determining A, what's happened, the circumstances, the cause, and identifying witnesses, obtaining relevant information which might enable you to consider recovery action or the potential exposure of that agency to potential third-party claims in a liability context. Detailed assessment of the damage and the possible ramifications and implications which that's going to then have from both a material damage and consequential loss perspective. It's also about looking at what the potential risks and concerns are to potential loss and damage further being increased, or most importantly, injury to persons, and arranging and implementing urgent security make-safe mitigation strategies along the way. As you'd imagine, there's lots of stakeholders, and it's recognising who those stakeholders are and them all being part of that process or being brought into that process. In the initial stage, obviously, the key parties are by name and pack drill, and who are they in a managerial or an operational sense. With management, it's obviously about understanding the structure and reported lines, the delegated authority communication protocols. From an operational point of view, it's about the people that are on the ground on the tools who will make things happen. They can be both internal within that agency, or it could be another agency that can assist. And actually, from that point of view, you know, state records is a classic example of where they can provide a resource and an assistance in the event of an event. External resources where the internals can't offer that capability or skill set, it's identifying them. And the key really is to seeing what does the event cause, what response does it need, the skill set, matching those skill sets and driving the recovery process. So all of that becomes the team. And in some instances, that can lead to what we call a project control group or a PCG. And in some of the major losses I've been dealt with, the importance of PCG is essential from the point of view that it makes sure every stakeholder has a forum and an avenue that they can communicate into. Left hand, right hand knows what's going on. They're involved in the process. People take ownership, accountability, and are all fully informed. The frequency of these PCG meetings obviously are defined by the nature and extent of the event, and they might initially be daily, they might be weekly, they might be monthly, and they're moved out according to need. The facilities in that team environment is critical because of everything that those parties and those stakeholders can bring to the process and make decisions in real time in what can often be a very fast-moving and highly pressured environment. So to bring the loss or damage under control, that image is a claim that is close to my heart because I spent a lot of time there. It was basically the Hinkler Shopping Centre, which at the time was owned by Mirvac, and it went underwater, which included three major supermarkets and 70 specialty shops. That site was closed for 4 months, had a soft opening, and then finally reopened in full after 9 months. It takes a long time to dry a very wet building. The first 5 minutes of the claim is what I often refer to, and obviously that's not literally, but it's about setting the tone and the conduct for the future path of that claim and the recovery process with all the moving parts that are going on. It's being able to look at A to Z in terms of damage, implications, how one thing will roll into another, and the material damage and business interruptions issues that are helicoptered so that you understand everything. I'll very often ask a lot of different questions, which people may say, I'm not sure why you're asking that, but there's a very clear purpose so I can clearly understand what the nature of the agency or risk is and how this event's going to impact them and where the drivers are in various angles. The people that know the agency or the business the best are the people that actually run it and own it and function it. Mitigation is critical to the recovery of anything with it after an event. And mitigation and make safe strategies need to be implemented in a fully informed manner with required skill sets, the knowledge of expertise of various parties coming in from internal or external sources. The key to mitigation will enable recovery because it minimises further loss or damage, but it will also minimise the period of disruption and obviously the effect on consequential loss in terms of either revenue or operations generally. In a recovery, you can have a very long make-safe stage, and I'll talk to that in one example with the collapse of Pelican Marina at the back end of the presentation. There's ongoing damage assessment. I refer to peeling back the layers of an onion. What you see on day one can be very different 3 weeks later, even 3 months later. And managing the various risks and issues and challenges that come along the way as you work towards ultimately finalising and developing the scope to reinstate and complete the project. Sense of timeliness and urgency is critical. Sometimes what happens is, and in fairness to anyone that goes through any claim, it's new, it's different, and you're not meant to know what to do. That's why you have a loss adjuster, an insurer, and a fund sitting behind all of that. But it's important that everyone's got the ear of each other so that they can hear and understand what the issues are. The need for decisions to be made at high speed sometimes is absolutely critical, and the sense of urgency that has to attach along the way, but those decisions being made in an informed, balanced, measured way. There's sometimes difficult decisions to make. Sometimes not everyone likes the decisions that are made, but it's how you deliver that message and those decision-making processes. It's about being fluid and flexible in that decision-making process, not being locked in on a position, being prepared to listen to what the issues and the challenges are and what is affecting that stakeholder group over here and the other stakeholder group over there. The skill sets that we look to bring in are people that are sometimes consultants, they're sometimes specialist contractors, restorers, valuers, these types of people that know what to do in that specific set of circumstance and critically analyse the issues to assist with bringing the whole project under control, giving it the direction it needs and working through the reinstatement process. Communication is key, I think, in anything, and communication takes lots of forms and people. Left-hand, right-hand is essential, and communication protocols, that might be something as simple as who wants to be on the email trail, who needs to be on the email trail. I think we all loathe global emails, and nobody wants emails in their inbox if they don't need it. Communication frequency, and obviously meeting those targets. And you know, I said I was going to get back to you at 3 o'clock today. I'll get back to you at 3 o'clock today. Managing those expectations all helps with that part of the process. There's various affected parties, directly or indirectly, and in some instances there's third parties who are aggrieved. They're angry. They're upset. They want answers. And they want to blame somebody. Media and crisis management probably go hand in hand. By virtue of the nature of some events and the agencies that are affected, they can have a very high profile event around that, and obviously issues of sensitivity, and that requires the requisite media management and engagement of the relevant agencies, public relations personnel. Those people are looking to the people that are on the ground who know what's going on in real time, such as the adjusters, the consultants and the like, for direction to inform the release of the information on a needs-to-know basis to various stakeholders and in some instances including the public and obviously the media. These days what we're seeing is actually a really important and good use of social media as a communication tool. It gets a message out quickly, and it's not all negative. Ministerial advice, by virtue of working for TMF and agencies, obviously does occur from time to time, and those matters will be elevated to ministerial level. It's critical that the flow of information in terms of timeliness, accuracy, and obviously its confidentiality is happening to enable the management and expectations of the people that are reporting to the various ministers' offices. A very good example of that occurred recently with an event which is in the public domain, which was the recent water flooding inundation of the law courts. That event occurred on a Sunday afternoon, and I was talking to people on Sunday night. The early assessment by the building facilities management and the risk measures that were implemented enabled them to advise the Chief Justice and the Attorney General that that building could not reopen the next day on Monday. The fact that it's the New South Wales Supreme Court, the Federal Court and also High Court meant that there were cases due to be heard that day. So obviously a contingency plan and the disaster management plan was implemented. The court cases that were listed for that Monday were relocated elsewhere, as were staff and obviously the various communication lines that happened and continued to happen over the coming hours and days. That building actually remained closed for 2.5 weeks, and when the Chief Justice issued the press release, his quote was, "It's good to be back in business." And it was. Material damage, reinstatement, how these costs are assessed and determined. That's a building that's actually in Kaiapoi in Christchurch. It actually looks okay. It was a heritage building. It was the former ANZ Bank of sort of 1860s. Heritage in Christchurch was very much on radar because of the nature of and the extent of damage which was suffered and the number of heritage buildings that could not be restored. In the end, after I think that was about 3 years, structural engineering, geotechnical engineering, the net effect of that building, it had slumped, and the effects of what was called liquefaction in Christchurch was a very unique phenomenon for everyone to deal with. And in the end, that building, it was determined after a lot of peer review and analysis, in order to repair it, it would need to be piled 20 metres deep at various locations. In consideration of the coverage, quite simply, it was uneconomical and it was deemed a constructive total loss, and that insured party was compensated. I believe the Heritage Council did seek to repair it. I'm not sure what happened. For all intents and purposes, you'd think that building was okay. The emergency MakeSafe, the scopes of work to reinstate, the procurement processes in recognition of obviously existing procurement arrangements that are in place are essential. And you're reinstating all heads of claim, so the building, the contents, the IT infrastructure, personal effects, documents, records, files, and the inputs of all the agencies that come along the way. Other factors which get taken into account include things like extra costs of reinstatement. A building, when it's damaged, needs to be reinstated in consideration of what we call the National Construction Code. You may formerly have known of the Building Code of Australia. And the statement of cover will respond to any of the upgrading works which are necessary to satisfy that or other government regulatory authority requirements. Some of the examples might be fire separation, fire services upgrades, disabled ambulance toilets, earthquake code compliance. And earthquake code compliance does apply in Australia as well. Another element which I've already touched on is heritage. Many of the assets that the agencies own have heritage status, and it's critical that the implications of heritage are understood with the input of heritage consultants, conservation management plans, and those types of source documents. A recent example of that is a fire which occurred in the Parramatta Park Cafe and Function Centre. The building itself is not heritage listed, but by virtue of the fact that it is sitting in the middle of Parramatta Park, which comes under the jurisdiction of Parramatta Park Trust, we do have to consider the effects and impacts of that building reinstatement, given the location of Old Government House and other heritage status areas in buildings in that precinct. Other issues that we look at are asbestos, and as well as that mould. These are risks which can become very problematic and very expensive. The existence of asbestos registers, and I'm pleased to say that agencies on their assets generally do keep very good asbestos registers, and that's a really important document that we get straight up. Where are we looking for asbestos? Is it here? Isn't it here? You will have all heard and seen horror stories on TV when all of a sudden asbestos becomes an issue. The situation of a fire, if there is asbestos which is burnt and it becomes what's called friable, that is an unhealthy state for the asbestos. It is not visible to the naked eye. And you can have, obviously, smoke. The fire starts here, but the smoke will go everywhere, including up floors, through rises, different levels, and obviously carpets, furniture, documents, files, etc., all get affected. If that smoke, and it's determined by hygienists and air monitoring and swab sampling, contains asbestos, it does put a very different picture on the response. Mould is, and its mitigation and its treatment, and this is a subject that I'm sure many of you are cognizant of, can be a real issue, and if it's not addressed quickly and responded to appropriately. When there's a water damage event, obviously there's always the risk of mould developing if the conditions are right. I'm not a scientist, I'm not a hygienist, but I can tell you reliably that we've all got mould here. Mould is here in this room, mould's in our homes, mould's in our bathrooms, and there is a safe level of mould. There is no standard of what is safe anywhere in the world. And to that extent, we look to the advice of experts around guidelines that are acceptable, and obviously different applications will apply depending on the nature and circumstances of the use. What might be deemed to be acceptable in this building may be very different to what is acceptable in a hospital environment. When something's wet, the idea is you stabilise it and dry it very quickly. And that includes throwing a lot of equipment at it quickly, keeping air conditionings going, introducing mechanical drying equipment to a site, removing wet documents, having them put into freeze dryers, starting the conservation processes, and by virtue of that, given the knowledge that State Records obviously does have in their disaster management response, using them as a tool and advice around assisting that process. There's various restoration companies available, hygienists, etc. I've got to say I've seen excellent, I've seen good, I've seen bad, and I've seen horrible. And as I said, it can happen in any environment. Consequential loss. Some losses will impact on the ability of an agency to earn revenue. As previously advised, the cover will respond to loss of gross revenue for the period of disruption. We look at historical record revenue versus actual financial accounts, trading profit and loss statements, management accounts, and need to establish what would have been the revenue but for the loss or the event. We look at increase in costs of working, additional expenditure, and in that regard, it really is a case of taking the intel of the agency and the operators, because they know their operation better than anyone. No idea is too silly, no question's too silly, and it's really about thinking laterally and outside of the box. It's hiring temporary classrooms, paying for additional parking or transport to take students from this school to that school, hiring equipment to speed up reinstatement, fast-tracking remediation, and those types of approaches. The data is obviously, from a financial point of view, treated with the strictest of confidence, and is obviously not divulged anywhere. When an event occurs where we believe there may be the potential for recovery action, now that can be something as straightforward as a car driving into a building, or it can be a fire which occurs and it's not unexplained. It's obviously about securing the evidence to identify what is the exact cause and identifying potential parties that may be liable for from a causation duty of care perspective. We don't just rely on the police and the fireys. We do recommend and often engage independent forensic and factual investigators. Sometimes investigations may be done in tandem with WorkCover or WorkSafe New South Wales, and it's about all of the teams moving together. I've done matters where the police have come to me and said, you've got the gun expert, can we use their brain? You know, so it's about a spirit of compromise and cooperation to get to an end game. Obviously, again, with the strictest of confidence. It's about gathering information, reports, eyewitness statements, contemporaneous notes, looking at social media. Interestingly, social media tells lots of stories these days. Service and maintenance and data records, and then engaging various consultants, experts to assist with the process. When a potential recovery is on foot, it's very often for us to raise our hands and say, can we be retained by lawyers to maintain legal professional privilege? The next big thing, which actually is probably a bit of a work in progress, is cybercrime. And you know, I think that's probably something that's relevant to your area, given the ongoing digitisation that's going on. Cyber attacks are changing as hackers are becoming more and more creative, and the scale and the nature of the impacts that are occurring and the damage is often variable. We're seeing malware, ransomware, theft of data, denial of service. And then we're trying to ascertain, as an insurance industry, lots of underwriters and brokers and insurers are scratching their heads and still are to this day around how this is going to manifest itself in claims and what those claims are going to be worth. We're seeing theft of private data, we're seeing third-party liability claims, director and officer claims, property claims, and we're also seeing business interruption implications. Crawford does have a cyber incident response team, and we are actually handling a claim currently for one of the agencies. What we look to do is provide an end-to-end solution, whether you're insured or not insured, and it's about a team, again, which includes forensic IT, legal, PR personnel, credit monitoring, project management, post-incident review. But as I said, it's fair to say it is a bit of a work in progress, and some might say the plane is still being built whilst it's being flown. I'll talk quickly to a couple of case studies and just show you some more photos. This is the water damage event some of you may be aware of that happened at the State Library. The photo on the left is the offending water pipe, and it basically let go overnight and inundated the, it's about 1300 square metre floor plan of the Murray Bashir reading room, which is the lower level. And it then went down to the floor below, which is their book collection area. They have a fantastic disaster response plan, the State Library, as I guess one would expect and hope. And they implemented that very quickly. There was a lot of water extraction, moving of books, protection, plastics, and the conservation team, who obviously are on hand there, removed items. There were books that were wet, freeze-drying, and inlaid with and opened up out in their conservation room. And that was a really good example of a mitigation strategy being implemented quickly. It was further enhanced, and the lower reading room was dried and occupied within about 1 week. And what could have been a very, you know, extensive claim, big claim, again with moisture, with books, was remediated and mitigated very quickly and very successfully. This is not an agency claim, I'm pleased to tell you, but I won't be naming who it is. It is an example of when medical records did get wet and was not responded to quickly enough. And It was actually a very small area of damage. You can see the blue tarp, that was the area of files that were affected. And the process that was implemented was done initially correctly, but probably not followed through. And the files basically were not dried sufficiently. And the image on the left is obviously one of the files that's still damp and wet when I arrived there 6 weeks after the event. And the rest of the storage room, which was potentially exposed to moisture and mould. And that actually is still on in progress, that matter. And it's involved a lot of input with hygienists and advisors and restoration specialists. And it will recover, but it's probably been far more extensive and intensive than it needed to be. Pelican Marina collapse. This was a matter for the Office of Environment and Heritage. That is an aerial view of the marina, which you'll see is built on Lake Macquarie, right near a channel, and it collapsed into Lake Macquarie. It was a very sudden and unforeseen collapse, and it included multiple commercial and residential tenants. There was somebody in that building when it actually collapsed and scurried safely away, fortunately. It was very intense, lots of media interest, lots of finger pointing and agency involvement, minister involvement, PR, media, and needed obviously lots of attention in various means. The reason this was so necessary to deal with it urgently, it could not wait around for the traditional procurement processes to make safe. There was a team of engineers involved with New South Wales Public Works, structural coastal engineers. The very big risk for this building was that it would suffer further catastrophic collapse and go into the lake, and the speed of the water rushing in and out of that would end up, the building may end up down on Swansea Bridge, which obviously was a bit of a problem for RMS. A method was involved where the building was actually anchored back under engineering advice, and we had people in boats with, we had a net put around the building, and then we slowly but surely deconstructed that building. Lots of cranes, lots of contractors, ongoing monitoring, and I'm pleased to say there were no incidents, no injuries, no further collapse of the building, and it was a really, you know, good example of what a team and a group of people can do in a informed and measured way. Not long after it was deconstructed, there was a Aboriginal land claim placed on the site, and so at this stage there's no plans to reinstate that building whilst the claim is on foot and being considered. But what the agency's claim is the cost to deconstruct and remediate that site in consideration of the orders that were placed on it by council, and we do need to stabilise that bank, and the plan is to eventually return it to public usage as a park or something like that. Sort of shows you the building, the temporary works. And we also had independent engineers that they did a very detailed analysis on the cause of the collapse, and that's them there measuring the piles that went into the sand bed underneath the building as part of that process. This is a school fire at Marsden High School. That's an aerial view of the site. Blocks A and B, the fire started in Block A, and smoke travelled all the way around through to Block B, across Block A and down to Block D. The remediation process, we did have potential asbestos there as per the asbestos register and where the fire started. The fire was initially advised by the police as being deliberately lit, which we actually proved to be incorrect. Currently the blocks A and B are unable to be used, so there's lots of demountable buildings on that site. There's various heads of claim, IT, documents, commercial kitchens. That's the fire origin there on the left. And that's a laboratory next door to it, and the hallway adjacent to it shows you the extent of heat and smoke that went through the site. The commercial kitchens, we've been able to clean and remediate and protect those, and they will be fine once the rest of the building is remediated. That shows you the image on the right. That is a staff room probably 50 metres away from the fire, and it's upstairs, and that shows you how far the smoke can go. Fortunately, we didn't have asbestos confirmed, and it's being cleaned and remediated, and we've packed out contents, and the school's getting on with life, albeit under temporary and difficult circumstances. The fire actually happened in the midst of HSC trials, so that created a bigger issue as well for the principal, the staff, and the students. IT. And this is a claim I'm doing for SOPA at the moment, which is a fire in the Monsters Skate Park. Some of you might go skateboarding out there, but I suspect most of you have been in this building because it's part of the Royal Easter Show, and it's where they show the sheep and the cows and the chickens. So it gets bumped out and bumped back in every year for the Easter Show. The building that's highlighted is the building where the fire is. It's about a 3,800 square metre building. Those buildings were purpose-built for the 2000 Sydney Olympics. And the fire, we put a drone over this building inside and outside because we couldn't get engineers up in it initially because of our concerns around safety and structural integrity. We were concerned about loose sheets flapping around in the breeze, and obviously its proximity in a very public area. There was a detailed forensic investigation done on the cause, and that gives you some sense of the nature of the fire and the smoke damage that's been sustained. It went through a stage one make-safe remediation, and that enabled strip out, clean recovery of that building, but primarily to enable us to reopen the other hall for the legacy sports that operate out of there. So that photo on the left is the temporary wall and hoarding that was put in place. All of this is done with consideration to building compliance, access, egress, fire services. You can't open a building to the public just by cleaning it up a bit. It's got to be done properly. And finally, to our beautiful Opera House. iCare, as you would imagine, also covers the Opera House. I haven't had the honour of handling a claim there, and I hope I never do, as in I hope there's never an event which would give rise to a claim at the Opera House. That's it from me. Thank you for your time and attention.